You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Thursday, September 29th. Feast day of the Archangels, Saints Michael, Gabriel, and Raphael. All three on this day. So give thanks for the angels, those invisible ministers. Very mysterious beings. But we'll invoke their intercession today. Michael, who's the kick-butt angel, let's just put it that way. Love the statue of him standing on the devil's throat. So we got that going for you, which is nice. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to be a part of the program anytime during the day. Got some good guests. Bottom of the hour, Nick Repatrizone. Nick, who writes for a number of publications, but we'll be talking specifically about an article he wrote for The Atlantic, which is about The Exorcist and Catholic storytelling. There's, I guess, a remake TV version of the original film being made, and it has him sort of wistful for the days in which there were really great Catholic authors in the literary world with the Catholic imagination and storytelling, people like Walker Percy or Graham Greene or William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist, for example. And was able to catch up with Nick Repatrizone yesterday, and you'll hear some of that conversation at the bottom of the hour. Really, really good stuff, I think. And then in the next hour, it's a Thursday, so that means one thing, First Cup Theology with Father Alan Carter. And it is National Coffee Day, so how perfect is that? He'll be talking to us about the Examen Prayer, which is a great piece of Ignatian spirituality, but sometimes a little intimidating. He said an examine prayer for the rest of us, or as I like to call it, an examine prayer for dummies. We'll also talk about Colonel Jessup's popular God today, contradictions in Charlotte, and Arnold Palmer's deathbed friend. All that and more. If you want to be a part of the program, we'll give you the question of the day in the next segment. That's what they call in the radio biz, a tease. 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post a response on Facebook or Twitter. CB running the board today, ready to take your call if you want to chime in. Woke up this morning, as I typically do, in prep for the show, flipped over to ABCNews.com and saw the story about another black man killed by police in El Cajon, California. El Cajon. Again, a troubling story. He had something in his hand, but it turned out to be a vape device from his pocket, not a weapon. And of course, now there are protests and the like in El Cajon, just as there's been in Tulsa, just as there's been in Charlotte, just as there has been in lots of different places. I saw this post from Stephen Graydonis, who is a deacon, and who is one of my favorite film critics, Catholic. You see him, Decent Films is his outfit. He writes, I think, for the National Catholic Register. You see him on Crux sometimes as well. Anyway, this was a post that he made just about 8 days ago. Read a little bit about it. And this is, I mean, I know these are hard issues, right? I mean, we all know people in law enforcement. The vast majority of people in law enforcement are outstanding people who serve and protect without much thanks, to be quite honest. It's dangerous work. Their family and friends, day after day, are concerned about their safety. Oftentimes they're in very dangerous situations and very dangerous places. It's very easy to sit back as an armchair quarterback and to judge. Yet at the same time, it certainly seems like there are too many of these stories for there not to be some realization that we've got a systemic issue in the way we deal with people of color in these situations. And I think to not acknowledge that in some way is to have one's head in the sand. Anyway, this is what Stephen Graydonis, who would hardly be accused of being a flaming liberal, wrote about 8 days ago. He said, "I'm sorry, which black man who was first tasered and then shot to death near his car by police in the last few days were we talking about?" I mean, it's sort of like, you know, if you were to say, how about that controversial interview Pope Francis gave? And immediately your reaction is, which one are we talking about? Same sort of situation here, except with much more deadly consequences. Which shooting of a black man by police are we talking about? As Graydonis says, and this, he wrote this before the shooting in El Cajon. The first was Terrence Crutcher, shot to death in Tulsa on Friday. He wrote this, this is 8 days ago. Crutcher's car was apparently broken down. Police initially said that Crutcher refused to show his hands, but that clearly wasn't true. Multiple police videos show Crutcher with his hands raised for some time before he's shot. And then, of course, Crutcher, what made it even worse is he lay there on the ground and basically bled to death without any real immediate aid rendered to him. Then you had the situation in Charlotte, North Carolina, Keith Lamont Scott. If you've seen the video of this, it is also, in my view, equally disturbing. Killed after emerging from his car outside a Charlotte, North Carolina apartment complex. Scott, married with 7 children. He was waiting for a school bus to drop off his kids, as he did every day. Evidently, police arrived on the scene searching for someone else when they saw Scott emerge from his car, reportedly with a gun. He then got back into his car. Police approached him. He emerged from his car again, allegedly with the gun. The officer who shot him was an undercover in plain clothes, not in a uniform. Reportedly, police tased him and then shot him 4 times. As I said, if you've seen the video, it's very troubling. Now we've got the situation in El Cajon, California. As it says on ABC News, the object a black man pulled from his pant pocket before being fatally shot by police in Southern California was not a deadly weapon, but a vape-smoking device. The man is Alfred Acuero Alongo of El Cajon. Protests, of course, have erupted in El Cajon, just 16 miles northeast of San Diego, following the shooting and into Wednesday evening. Evidently, police said they received a 911 call from the man's sister saying her brother was not acting like himself. He was walking in traffic. 2 officers located the man, described as an African-American in his 30s, behind a restaurant in the city. Alongo refused multiple instructions to remove his hand from his pocket, which caused 1 officer to draw his firearm. He ignored further commands and paced back and forth. Officers tried talking to him, and he rapidly drew an object from his front pants pocket, placed both hands together, and extended them rapidly toward the officer, according to the report, taking up what appeared to be a shooting stance. That's when he was shot several times and died. Now, each situation is unique, but there does seem to be a pattern, a tendency to treat people of color in these situations, I think, with a greater degree of itchy trigger finger, I guess you could say, than in other circumstances. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if it's greater police training. I don't know what's going to bring a sense of healing to this obvious racial tension going on in these communities. And like I said, I don't see how you can look at these things and say they have no grievance. I mean, obviously, they have grievance. I've got friends who are African-American who have experienced, not, of course, a shooting, but they've experienced the whole driving while black phenomenon. And it's a very disturbing thing, and we got to deal with it. Here's one of the things about the Charlotte situation. This was occurring to me yesterday. What I think are some sort of contradictions, and this is where, you know, things are just sheerly and purely partisan. We draw up sides oftentimes without thinking about the complexities of the side that we've taken and even the interior contradictions. I'll give you a case in point. My guess is those who would immediately defend law enforcement who shot Keith Lamont Scott for potentially having a gun, even though his hands were not raised, he was not pointing the weapon. I mean, North Carolina is an open carry state. So those who argue for our gun rights, are they the ones arguing for the right of Keith Lamont Scott to have a gun on him in an open carry state? My guess is if you did some sort of an opinion poll, you would find that those who argue most passionately for gun rights would in this case oppose those who speak up for Keith Lamont Scott. That makes no sense. Any more than it makes sense for those who would wave the rebel flag to be critical of those who refuse to stand for the national anthem. But see, we are in an irrational age. There's no consistency in our thinking. And what we do, and I want to talk about this a little bit in the second hour, I think we have come to sort of create this God that we almost don't know we've created. But if you dig very deep, you discover we have a great devotion to this God. It's the God of safety, and we're willing to sacrifice anything, even our deepest principles, for this God of safety. If you don't believe me, we'll talk about it the second hour, because it's a real thing, I think, and it makes me think of Colonel Nathan Jessup. Sorry to go all movie on you, but a few good men. I'll explain in the second hour. We'll be back with a question of the day. If you got a thought, 573-4BREAD-4. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Feast of the Archangels. Saints Michael, Gabriel, Raphael. I didn't know about Raphael when I was a Protestant Christian. Never heard him talked about, mainly because I think the only biblical book where he really appears is the book of Tobit, which is not part of the Old Testament for Protestant Christians. It's a shame, too, because, man, it's a great book. And Raphael, who is a guide in the book to Tobit. So Saints Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, pray for us. If you want to learn more about Breadbox Media and what we're doing here through this digital enterprise, spreading the truth and the love of Jesus Christ and sharing the beauty and the richness of the faith, the church he founded upon St. Peter and the Apostles, you can check it out at breadboxmedia.com. You can also become a friend of your favorite show. My buddies at the Catholic Man Show. Adam Minahan, for one, if you've seen, there's a great YouTube ad on for them for becoming a friend of the show. I need to come up with something like that to promote that here, but through your monthly support, you can receive access to exclusive online content. You can also listen to podcasts of your favorite shows, expose yourself to some of the other contributors here at Breadbox through iTunes, Google Play, Podbean. You can listen to podcasts or even subscribe, so check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Our question of the day, it's National Coffee Day. And so it's a great excuse to tip a cup of Joe. What is your ideal cup of coffee? 573-4BREAD-4. If you want to chime in, you can call or text, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Bonnie already chiming in this morning. Dunkin' Donuts, 100%. She says, I see that. You know, these coffee taste survey test. Dunkin' Donuts always comes out I think even higher than Starbucks, probably for a good bit lower price. But Bonnie, I'm wanting to know too, though, what kind of coffee do you put stuff in it and so forth? So maybe follow back up with an email if you're still attuned. 573-4BREAD-4, your ideal cup of coffee. We got a few responses on this on Facebook. That's another way to chime in via social media. Mike Allen Show, the handle on Twitter or on Facebook. Let's see the responses we've gotten here. National Coffee Day. I couldn't find my Breadbox Media stainless steel mug, so my coffee's rapidly going cold on me this morning. Kristen says, fancy stuff. A Snickers latte on a normal day, taste of San Antonio, or hazelnut, both with half and half. Deacon Kevin says, Folgers mocha swirl with sweet almond milk, whipped cream, and a little caramel. Well, aren't you a fancy pants? And Leo says, like I like my comedy, dark and black. Listen, I'm right there with you, Leo. Just give me, I mean, I'm so boring. If I ever go into Starbucks, which I rarely do because I'm not going to spend $4 or $5 on simply a cup of black coffee, which is what I get. I want something like, you know, something the more bold a brew of coffee, like a Colombian, for example, and just give it to me black. Quicker to the bloodstream that way with the caffeine. I went black years ago on my coffee and don't regret it. So that's me. I'm pretty boring. I don't like your flavored stuff. Please don't be, you know, giving me some sort of vanilla flavored coffee or, you know, anything like that. Snickerdoodle. I don't need any of that. Just give me good, straight black coffee. I'm boring that way. But you're willing, you're free to chime in. 573-4BREAD-4. Joey Votto watch. Of course, the Reds beating the Cardinals 2 out of 3 now in this end of season series when the Cardinals are still a little bit behind in the wild card race. It's a small solace to me for the Reds' terrible season, but it is pretty remarkable, I have to say, because in prior years when the Reds actually had competitive teams, they struggled mightily against the St. Louis Cardinals. This year, Reds' worst team in probably decades, they've got a chance tonight to win the season series against the Cardinals. So that is, it may be, I know it doesn't make me a very good person. I know schadenfreude is not a Christian virtue, but to see the Reds playing spoiler is a little bit of fun. But Joey Votto last night, who is trying to become only the fourth player since 1941 to hit 400 for the second half of the season, post All-Star break, after going 3 for 5, actually 3 for 3 in last night's game before he went hitless in his last two at-bats, 0 for 5 last night. Makes him hitless in 7 straight at-bats, probably one of the longest streaks he's had since the All-Star break. So he's now hitting 404. The way I kind of figure it, Joey's got 99 hits and 245 at-bats. There's 4 games left. Let's say he ends up with 260 at-bats. He's going to need 104 hits. So if he can get 5 or 6 hits between now and Sunday, he'll be in like Flynn. Still a pretty remarkable second half for Mr. Votto. Came across a great article. Of course, we grieved earlier this week the passing of golf legend Arnold Palmer. And this from the CatholicHerald.com, which is a British publication. Benedictine Abbott was at Arnold Palmer's bedside when he died. Evidently, Benedictine Archabbot Douglas Nowicki of St. Vincent's Archabbey in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, was with Arnold Palmer when the golfing great died on September 25th in Pittsburgh. It wasn't the first time Archbishop Nowicki, or Archabbot, sorry, Nowicki had visited Palmer that day. Palmer, 87, was in the hospital awaiting a heart operation scheduled for the 26th. Nowicki says, I went to say a prayer and give him a blessing. About an after hour I departed, I got a call that Palmer's health was failing rapidly, the Archabbot told the Catholic News Service. Now, even though Arnold Palmer was a lifelong Presbyterian, he had had a relationship with St. Vincent spanning more than 50 years. So a Presbyterian with Catholic sympathies, almost sort of a religious Arnold Palmer, if you get the idea, right? Tea and lemonade. Anyway, when Archabbot Nowicki himself was in high school at the Arch Abbey, that's how far back their friendship with Palmer, as I said, did not let differences deter him. Arnie sort of appealed to everyone, said the Archabbot. There were no barriers, race, color, creed. Those were things that never entered into his mind. He was welcoming to everybody and treated everyone with tremendous warmth and respect. Everybody except maybe for Ben Hogan. We talked about that earlier this week. Sometimes he would even come to the Archabbey 7:30 a.m. Sunday Mass with his wife. I'll post a link to this on the show's Facebook page. This is a pretty cool article and gives you a little bit of a window into the man, Mr. Palmer. All the more reason to appreciate him and certainly pray, as we should for all of our beloved dead, pray for the repose of his soul. All right, so let's move on now to our What Were You Thinking nominees of the day. Go dumb or go home, as we like to say. Evidently, another reported scary clown sighting, this time in Brevard County in Florida. Kelly Reynolds of Palm Bay was on Sunday evening stroll with her dog, Brindle. Something spooked the dog, and Reynolds turned to look. She stopped and started growling, and there were two people dressed like clowns peering over from a wooded area near a fence. I'm telling you right now, somebody's going to get hurt. One of these clowns. And you know what it could end up being? An innocent clown. We talk about how all the so many good, loyal, faithful, level-headed police officers in the world have to take the rap for officers who do dumb things or who do violent things unnecessarily. Well, I guess you could say the same thing about all the good clowns in the world. Evidently, this is becoming a problem. Otherwise, good clowns unable to go out in public and do what they do best, whatever that may be. But anyway, so that's our first nominee. These people who obviously copycat situations are going to get themselves hurt by dressing as clown. Nominee number two, it's a little more serious. This is at East Tennessee State University. A man arrested, a barefoot man, wearing overalls and a gorilla mask, was trying to hand out noose-wrapped bananas to Black Lives Matter demonstrators. Was taken away by public safety officers Wednesday afternoon. Really? Look, you may not agree with the Black Lives Matter movement. I get that. I understand that. But really, you go out in a gorilla mask and you hand out bananas attached to nooses? My goodness. But the winner we're going to give to the people who decided to steal a Mercedes and they didn't realize that the Mercedes had as one of its features a geolocation device on board. So they were quickly apprehended. This is from Yakima, Washington. Man, modern technology. It'll get you every time. When we get back from the break, we're going to talk to Nick Repatrizone, a writer, a literary and film critic. He's going to talk about the remake, the TV series remake of The Exorcist, and how it makes him wistful for the days in which Catholic storytelling had more of a presence in our national culture and how we can maybe get back there again. So we'll talk to him on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show, and you're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
minutes past the hour and before the hour. See how math works? It's a beautiful thing. Welcome back into the Mike Allen Show. Again, my question of the day on this feast day of the three archangels, also National Coffee Day. What is your ideal cup of coffee? Bonnie emails back, not just Dunkin' Donuts, a little organic whole milk and a dash of organic coconut palm sugar in her Dunkin' Donuts coffee. She said there's deals everywhere on coffee today. And, of course, she points out that Coach John Calipari of the Kentucky Wildcats, it's Calipari, not Pari, please. Anyway, likes his Dunkin' Donuts coffee, too. Anyway, I had a chance yesterday to catch up with Nick Repatrizone. Nick Repatrizone, who had an article in The Atlantic on The Exorcist and Catholic storytelling. Just a little bit more about Nick. He's a contributor to The Atlantic, a staff writer at The Millions. He's written for Esquire, Rolling Stone, The Kenyon Review, and other publications. His books include The Fine Delight, A Consideration of Contemporary Catholic Writing. He teaches at the College of New Jersey. My conversation with Nick Repatrizone.
Hello, Nick. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I came across this article that you wrote in The Atlantic, The Exorcist and the Lost Art of Catholic Storytelling. It reminded me of an article that you'd written a number of months ago. In fact, I had tried to get you on the program, and for whatever reason, circumstances, it didn't allow it, where you wrote a piece about Graham Greene, the great almost tortured Catholic novelist, who I have a particular affection for because it was Graham Greene who introduced me to the Catholic faith. But I saw a connection between your two pieces, and that was really understanding the power of Catholic storytelling, not as sort of tidy hagiographies, but exploring even the complexities and darkness of human life.
Yeah, I think I'd like you to talk about how Graham Greene was someone that you were looking at during your own conversion, because there's always a constant sense, I think, of struggle, both in his nonfiction and his fiction. Power and the Glory, the reason why I had chosen that for the Atlantic piece, the first one, was that I thought it was a perfect representation of Lent in a way that other fictional narratives weren't able to capture. And Greene, I think, in a certain way, has continued to influence, or certainly influenced, the 1960s and 1970s American Catholic writers, kind of channeling that sense of intermingling of doubt and faith and struggle and sin, all those things working together and off of each other.
Yeah, in the newer article, you use the occasion of the release of the Exorcist remake in a television version, a series that I think started, as you said, this past Friday night, used it as an opportunity to reminisce, I guess, sort of wistfully about a day in American culture when Catholic storytelling was really at its strongest, with one example being William Peter Blatty's Exorcist novel and its subsequent film.
Yeah, I think what happened with Blatty, the novel in 1971 and then the film a few years later, was his book was kind of in the midst of, I guess you call it, a Catholic literary revival. The Flannery O'Connors, the Walker Percy's, Jack Kerouac, Hemingway, who was a convert, J.F. Powers, John Kennedy Toole, all these writers are working at the same time, and they are the very so-called public in their intellectualism as Catholics. They are seen in the secular literary world as being writers of the highest order. They're not seen as people who just write purely devotional works, which certainly have their place in a Catholic or a Christian culture. But I think there was a certain power to transcending that. And Blatty, who was Jesuit educated at Georgetown, was someone who, in his own way, was able to channel this in a very graphic and disturbing horror novel that became, you know, a pretty disturbing film, but is just sort of a iconic Catholic narrative that, adjusted for inflation, is the highest-grossing horror film of all time, still to date.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm 50 years old, so I can remember, you know, being, 12, 13 years old and The Exorcist being on TV. And, of course, I was not a Catholic at the time. And a number of years ago, when I first began to discover that Blatty was a Catholic and he meant this novel to actually be a story of redemption, it was surprising to me because all I remember it being was something that terrified me late at night.
I think that's the Jesuit I think, in him. He didn't become one himself, but certainly his Jesuit instruction and the sense that he was very comfortable allowing suffering and doubt, certainly of Father Karras, to be the center of the narrative. The family, the McNeil family, is a secular family. They're not really Christian in any way. The mother appears to be rather agnostic. So they're juxtaposed with this very Catholic world of Georgetown, where she's filming her new movie. And Father Karras, played by Jason Miller, is able to kind of just give us a ideal representation of a flawed character, kind of like a whiskey priest, who brings grace and peace to people who need it the most.
Yeah, as you say, that, you know, The Exorcist stands as uniquely memorable for its often shocking portrayal of Catholic redemption through suffering. And you mentioned some other films around the same era, maybe within the same decade: The Sound of Music, Man for All Seasons, Rosemary's Baby, The Godfather, The Omen, Rocky. I mean, all of them really with a different facet of Catholicism, certainly, you know, different perspectives, different overall thematic emphases and stuff, but really was, I guess, in many ways, sort of a golden age of heavy Catholic presence in film.
Yeah, looking back, it's even when I was writing the article, it was just, it's almost fascinating to think of how every year, one of the either higher grossing films or a film that was critically lauded towards the top of awards tended to be in some way Catholic. It was almost like an annual thing that it would happen. And like you said, they were Catholic in very different ways. But I think the thing about Catholicism, you know, both the capital C and lower, you know, KC Catholic, is that it's such a incredibly diverse, complicated faith and culture that it's just it's amazing the art that can come from it, and the range of that art.
You then say that nearly 45 years later, and as I mentioned, prompted by the remake of The Exorcist that's come out now as a television series starting last Friday night, but you said nearly 45 years later, after The Exorcist's initial publication, the world of Catholic storytelling is barely recognizable. Talk about that for a minute, and the question of whether it is whether it's more symptomatic of a culture, let's say, that is much less Catholic.
My work with that has been kind of happening over the years, but around 2013, I had written a book for Catskey Books from Whips and Stock, the Find a Light, where I tried to compile kind of post-Vatican II Catholic literature to try to figure out, after the time of Flannery O'Connor to the present, what was happening with Catholic writers. So I made most of the book about writers like the late André Dubuc and Ron Hanson, who actually is a deacon out in California. And I wrote about some other poets and nonfiction writers. And my argument in the book was that Catholic literature is alive, but it's kind of in at little corners, and it's maybe more present in like the smaller independent presses and the literary magazine world and the mainstream kind of affecting literary culture world. Around that same time, actually about a year later, the now poet laureate of California, Dana Gioia, wrote an essay, The Catholic Writer Today, which is published in First Things. And he made the argument, and I quote him in the Atlantic essay, that at the highest levels of literature, that Catholic writing is not as sort of discussed or recognized in comparison with earlier generations. So kind of going even back before what I did, back in like the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And he says there's 68 million American Catholics, but it doesn't have like a relative influence on literary culture. So when I read his, at first I was kind of hesitant to kind of embrace sort of like a narrative decline. But then, you know, the more I was thinking about it, when I was compiling my Catholic literature, I was more trying to kind of collect information rather than necessarily argue it's good, bad, or not. Mm. And the more that I kind of looked at him and looked at some other writers looking at post-secular or post-modern literature, I noticed that there were a lot of really, really good cultural Catholic writers, I guess you can call them, people who were raised Catholic or went to Catholic school but no longer practice. That includes Toni Morrison, Don DeLillo, Thomas Pynchon, Cormac McCarthy. These are just major, major, very important writers who are undeniably Catholic if you look and sometimes write about Catholics, but they are not practicing. And it's hard to sometimes parse what that means, mm-hmm. practicing, but because everybody has their own way of living. But, you know, these are people who talk about how important Catholicism is to them, but as a metaphor. Whereas the people who speak of Catholicism, Ron Hansen being sort of the one that I always go back to, Phil Clay, who won the National Book Award for Fiction a few years ago, and Hatchett. You know, there's certainly writers there who are great Catholic storytellers. But when you take a more, I guess, statistical or literary analysis of their overall significance in the broader culture, it seems to be far less than it used to be, which is, I think, a shame.
We'll be back with more in just a minute. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this feast day of the archangels, Michael, Gabriel, and Raphael. Gabriel, by the way, one of the patron saints of radio. He's the messenger, you know, so Saint Gabriel, pray for us here at Breadbox Media. We'll continue on with my conversation with Nick Repatrizone. Nick Repatrizone, a contributor to The Atlantic, a staff writer at The Millions. He has written for Esquire, Rolling Stone, The Kenyon Review, and other publications. His books include The Fine Delight, A Consideration of Contemporary Catholic Writing, and he teaches at the College of New Jersey. We're talking about his article in The Atlantic called The Exorcist and the Lost Art of Catholic Storytelling, in which he uses the occasion of the remake of The Exorcist into a TV series to sort of lament the current state of Catholic storytelling in literature and film. So more in my conversation with Nick Repatrizone. And one of the realities that you point out is that contemporary culture is also not going to be as conversant in Catholicism, maybe even at a subconscious level, when only a quarter of Catholics or less attend weekly Mass, 14% of millennial Catholics attend Mass every week, whereas back in 65, I guess, over half of Catholics attended Mass and over 60% in 1958. And so maybe there was some more of a conscious awareness maybe of the Catholic undercurrents in the films as well. So it's, I guess it's sort of a dual problem.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think, I know working for a lot of secular magazines, you know, places like The Atlantic and Esquire, Kenyon Review, there's so many people who are in the literary world who are cultural Catholics, who have education in the church, who love the symbolism and the dramatic narratives, who are open to these stories, but who, as you say, kind of are only open to them in a distant way, in a cultural way, as opposed to a more directly religious way. And I think the readership or the viewership of the earlier generations were very primed to embrace these narratives as conversant with their actual day-to-day life. Whereas now when a so-called cultural Catholic reads one of these stories, it's kind of a novelty. It reminds them of something, but doesn't grab them in the same way as, you know, imagining a practicing Catholic going into a cinema in 1973 and watching The Exorcist, really believing that this could happen.
You know, I know a number of people, of course, I'm one of them, who this kind of Catholic storytelling actually cracked open a door to curiosity and ultimately to openness to the faith and the beauty and the richness. I mean, I was already a Christian, but, you know, encountering the Catholic faith and the Mass and so many Catholic images in Graham Greene's novels, that's one of the great things about Catholic storytelling. Not that it's written intentionally and directly as an evangelistic tool, but it does have that effect.
Yeah, it's the way that you talk about this makes me think of how I think much of the best Catholic storytelling is really suffused. It's atmospherically Catholic rather than having theses or trying to convert. I think Catholic writing tends to be really interested in sinners and the concept of evil in a way that is simultaneously kind of ancient and modern. Like, I think what The Exorcist does so well is it is Father Karras who is the skeptic initially of the demonic possession. When the mother of Reagan meets up with him outside of Georgetown, he's talking about psychiatry and he's talking about medicine. So Catholicism, I think, is able to wed the ancient and the modern in a storytelling way that is very eye-opening for someone reading it.
As they say, everybody makes fun of the Catholic Church until they need an exorcist.
Exactly.
So you've seen the remake, at least the first episode, last Friday night, you said, of the new TV series of The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. What were your initial thoughts?
Well, I certainly enjoyed the fact that there was a television show on primetime Friday night at 9 o'clock that speaks to Catholic themes, and I think it's a show where faith and struggling with faith and a faith community. There are a lot of scenes taking place at Mass and at church, people talking about things that they can't understand, sort of mysterious grace that they kind of encounter they can't name. I thought overall, I think one of the things about the film is that it's such a tightly crafted narrative in an hour and a half. We see a gradual spiritual journey. I think the concern with the television show is that it might be just a television medium, but it just sounded like some of the Catholic themes were fast-forwarded and sort of using, I think one of the problems with mainstream representations of Catholicism is that they use iconographic things like a cross or a crucifix or things like that as just kind of like very shorthand for very complicated and complex and emotional feeling. Whereas I think the film really takes its time and develops things. And really the crescendo of the film, the pure, intense, demonic battle, isn't a long time. It's a relatively small part of the movie, which is mostly just building the idea of how could evil infect this child.
So now, Nick, you grew up Catholic, right? So did you have an interest in Catholic storytelling from a fairly young age through literature, through film?
Yes. I grew up Italian Catholic family. My wife is Catholic. I went to Catholic school all the way through, and her family's from Spain and Ecuador. So when you put Italian and Spanish Catholics, who are all very superstitious and very into very like intense storytelling, it kind of percolates. So I definitely am interested in why Catholic storytelling isn't spoken about more. And, when I was coming up in my MFA program and, writing now for magazines, people kind of jokingly refer to me as like the staff Catholic because I'm kind of the guy who, has these interests in other things. And then I'm happy when secular places let me talk about them in a way that gets people reading about them. So I love the fact that you know, for me, like I said, there's definitely a kind of a natural inclination of mine towards storytelling that tries to get to very deep and then complicated issues, but does it in a way that is ambiguous and complex and, you know, does it hopefully with the highest level of fiction.
Well, I've been a fan of The Atlantic for some time, so it just deepens my appreciation for the magazine that it gives space for Catholicism to be treated fairly and, you know, in such a positive way, and appreciate the great work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
All right. Blessings to you and to your family. And now, like I said, you need to go watch The Exorcism of Emily Rose, so I want to hear what your thoughts are on that.
I will.
All right. Take care, Nick.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I talked to Nick about that after we got off the phone. He's got to see The Exorcism of Emily Rose, because that's some really good storytelling, I think, and a very heavily Catholic undercurrents in that film, even though I think it was directed by an evangelical. And also recommend that he see Calvary, which is a very dark, hard movie to watch, starring Brendan Gleeson. If you recall from Braveheart, Mel Gibson's burly, redheaded ginger friend, he plays a priest in the film Calvary, which is very dark, but it is about a good priest in the midst of quite a difficult struggle. So I wouldn't recommend it for family viewing fare, but Calvary, very, very good as well. But it's great to have people like a Nick Repatrizone out there writing in major publications like The Atlantic, because, you know, I think one of the beautiful things about the Catholic faith, I was thinking about this yesterday, Catholics don't need a privileged position in the culture. We just need a place at the table, because the power of the Catholic vision and the Catholic idea and the Catholic worldview, if it simply just has a place at the table, it's going to attract. It's going to draw, because there's a beauty in the Catholic way of looking at the world and understanding the world. It just makes sense. Anyway, let's look back in history a little bit on this day. Like I said, it is National Coffee Day. If you want to tell me your favorite type of coffee, I'd love to hear from you. 573-4-BREAD-4. But what are some other things on this day? Pope Leo the Great, Leo the First, who talked Attila the Hun, I think, out of sacking Rome, installed on this day in 440 AD. In 1954, New York Giants center fielder Willie Mays made a running catch with his back to home plate on a 450-foot blast by Cleveland Indians batter Vic Wertz in Game 1 of the World Series. Now, wait a minute. That's what it said on this historical thing. 450-foot blast? I don't know all the ballparks, but unless he was in the parking lot outside the stadium. Anyway, maybe they took total distance up and down on that one. In 1960... My Three Sons, starring Fred McMurray, debuted on ABC. On this day in 1957, the New York Giants played their last game at the Polo Grounds before moving to San Francisco. By the way, Vin Scully was calling the games for the Dodgers at the same time. He's just now giving up the mic this weekend. And on this day, let's see, happy birthday to Kevin Durant, who is 28 years old. We'll see how he does this season with the Golden State Warriors. A lot of pressure on that team. That's absolutely sure. And then 11 years ago, John Roberts sworn in as the nation's 17th Chief Justice. We'll be back with a new hour, including Father Alan Carter. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.